Good evening. The Democrats debate as witnesses before the House Intelligence Committee deliver more bad news for Trump. And in New York, a law makes it easier for workers to get paid. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Thursday, November 21st, 2019. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Thursday he would not resign despite being charged with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in a corruption scandal that he denounced as an attempted coup. The charges were the first of their kind against a serving Israeli prime minister and represented the gravest crisis in the political career of Israel's longest-serving leader. Netanyahu has dominated Israeli politics for a generation, decisively turning the country to the right. He has denied wrongdoing in the three graft cases, saying he is the victim of a political witch hunt. His rejection of the charges echoed the pugnacious language of his ally, U.S. President Donald Trump. Britain urged Israel to halt its counterproductive settlement expansion on Thursday, saying it was illegal under international law. The UK Foreign Office reiterated its position on the settlements after the United States on Monday effectively backed Israel's right to build Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. The position of the UK on settlements is clear, it said in a statement. They are illegal under international law, present an obstacle to peace, and threaten the viability of the two-state solution. We urge Israel to halt its counterproductive settlement expansion. And the commercial real estate company WeWork, that provides temporary workspace to technology startups in New York City, laid off 2,400 employees today. The company's attempt to go public was widely reported as botched, and the company's losses were mounting while its founder, Adam Neumann, had resigned. In a statement, WeWork said the cuts were being made as part of the company's effort to create a more efficient organization and refocus on the core office sharing business. The layoffs represent 19% of WeWork's total workforce. The company's chief investor, the Japanese-owned conglomerate SoftBank, is owned by billionaire Masayoshi Son. He said he had made a mistake with the company that cost him $4 billion. And a 14-year-old boy who opened fire at his Southern California high school, killing two classmates and wounding three others before shooting himself in the head, used a ghost gun built from parts. Nathaniel Tanasuke Burho pulled the .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol from his backpack on November 14th, his birthday, and shot students at Saugus High School in the Los Angeles suburb of Santa Clarita. The gun had no serial number, and the local sheriff said it had been assembled from a kit. Kit guns are sold legally at gun shows and online and are sometimes called 80% guns because they are roughly 80% assembled when purchased. The impeachment drama in Washington, D.C. continues today. We have this report.
I'm Jesse Lent with WBAI's Impeachment Watch. Today was, as far as we know, the final day of public hearings on the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Testimony was heard from former White House advisor Fiona Hill, an expert on Russia who reported to then National Security Advisor John Bolton, and David Holmes, a staff member at the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine who reports to Ambassador Bill Taylor. Though not originally scheduled to appear, after Ambassador Taylor revealed in his own testimony during last week's impeachment hearings that Holmes had told him about an incident on July 26th when he was sitting across from Gordon Sondland in a restaurant in Kyiv and the ambassador to the EU took out his cell phone and called President Trump. Because of the firsthand nature of his testimony, House Democratic leadership asked David Holmes to appear in today's public hearing. Here he is, describing what happened next in his opening statement from this morning.
During the lunch, Ambassador Sondland said that he was going to call President Trump to give him an update. Ambassador Sondland placed a call on his mobile phone, and I heard him announce himself several times along the lines of Gordon Sondland holding for the president. It appeared that he was being transferred through several layers of switchboards and assistants, and I then noticed Ambassador Sondland's demeanor changed and understood that he had been connected to President Trump. While Ambassador Sondland's phone was not on speakerphone, I could hear the president's voice through the earpiece of the phone. The president's voice was loud and recognizable, and Ambassador Sondland held the phone away from his ear for a period of time, presumably because of the loud volume. I heard Ambassador Sondland greet the president and explain he was calling from Kyiv. I heard President Trump then clarify that Ambassador Sondland was in Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do.
Holmes went on to recount a conversation he had with Ambassador Sondland directly after he hung up the phone about President Trump's priorities in Ukraine.
After the call ended, Ambassador Sondland remarked that the president was in a bad mood, as Ambassador Sondland stated it was often the case early in the morning. I then took the opportunity to ask Ambassador Sondland for his candid impression of the president's views on Ukraine. In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not, and Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing.
Though there wasn't the same kind of firsthand testimony from former White House advisor Fiona Hill, Ms. Hill refused to be shaken or misrepresented by some of the more forceful moments of questioning from congressmen like John Ratcliffe of Texas or Dr. Brad Wunstrup of Ohio. And while there have been no shortage of strong personalities testifying for these public impeachment hearings, Ms. Hill is the first to actually admonish Republican members of Congress who have attempted to confuse the facts for their own political benefit, as she did in her 8-minute opening statement, where she warned members of the House Intelligence Committee, like Ranking Member Devin Nunes, who continue to espouse the widely debunked conspiracy theory that it was actually Ukraine, not Russia, who hacked our election systems in 2016.
I do not think long-term conflict with Russia is either desirable or inevitable. I continue to believe that we need to seek ways of stabilizing our relationship with Moscow, even as we counter their efforts to harm us. Right now, Russia's security services and their proxies have geared up to repeat their interference in the 2020 election. We are running out of time to stop them. In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests. As Republicans and Democrats have agreed for decades, Ukraine is a valued partner of the United States, and it plays an important role in our national security. And as I told the committee last month, I refuse to be part of an effort to legitimize an alternate narrative that the Ukrainian government is a U.S. adversary and that Ukraine, not Russia, attacked us in 2016. These fictions are harmful even if they are deployed for purely domestic political purposes. President Putin and the Russian security services operate like a super PAC. They deploy millions of dollars to weaponize our own political opposition research and false narratives. When we are consumed by partisan rancor, we cannot combat these external forces as they seek to divide us against each other, degrade our institutions, and destroy the faith of the American people in our democracy.
For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. Steven Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. He says impeachment observers shouldn't forget that Congressman Adam Schiff, chairing the House Intelligence Committee, is no friend of progressives.
Adam Schiff is one of the more conservative Democrats in Congress. He is a strong supporter of the Iraq War, of the Israeli occupation, and on areas ranging from civil liberties to human rights, international law, the United Nations. He has often sided with Republicans against the majority of his fellow Democrats. And so I think we should be careful that while the impeachment inquiry should be defended, not to fall into a trap of acting like Adam Schiff is some kind of progressive hero.
Give us some background on what are some of these things that he, what are the positions he's taken that are not progressive, in your opinion?
I'm primarily familiar with his foreign policy position, which is definitely in the hawkish wing, in addition to supporting the Bush and Cheney against the majority of his fellow Democrats on the question of whether the U.S. should invade Iraq. He has been one of the biggest Likudniks in Congress, that is, supporter of Netanyahu and his policies in defending the settlements, the illegal Israeli outposts in occupied Palestinian territories. He has also supported legislation that would effectively ban campaigns for corporate responsibility and other BDS-type activities in opposition to the occupation, raising serious concerns from the American Civil Liberties Union and others. He's attacked the United Nations and various human rights organizations for documenting war crimes and other violations by the Israeli government, and ironic for someone who is being attacked for supposed liberal bias in an investigation. He trashed one of the world's leading international jurists, Richard Goldstone, in his committee's investigation of Israeli war crimes by both Hamas and Israel. And even though the investigation confirmed what Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other groups had found, and even though they were also quite critical of Hamas, the fact that they documented Israeli war crimes as well led him to denounce it as irredeemably biased and applauded the Bush administration for rejecting the findings and insisted that the findings be ignored.
In a sense, is a lot of this impeachment hubbub around the Ukraine about giving more weapons to Ukraine to fight Russia?
Schiff has been a big supporter of the United States arming Ukraine, and even those of us who are very critical of Russian maneuvers against Ukraine's sovereignty have raised concerns that more armaments would just lead to more killing, and there needs to be a diplomatic settlement. But I think the issues around the impeachment inquiry are less about whether or not the U.S. should arm Ukraine, but the reasons that Trump initially held up the delivery of these congressionally mandated arms shipments. It wasn't because he was concerned about fueling an arms race or creating a new Cold War or creating more bloodshed or any of the reasonable reasons one might disagree with the arms transfers, but he was using it as leverage, apparently, for investigations on a political opponent. So I think the inquiry on Trump's role in the Ukraine arms transfers is quite legitimate. But I do think that we should be careful not to therefore reach the conclusion that, oh, sending arms to Ukraine is a good thing.
What should we expect from Adam Schiff, and how should we withhold our credulity in some of these things?
He is a professional prosecutor prior to running for Congress. I do believe we should support Schiff as far as it goes in terms of pursuing the impeachment inquiry. What we shouldn't do is assume that he has a progressive agenda, and we should be cautious that this inquiry is not used as an excuse for renewing a Cold War against Russia.
Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi met the media today. She says the partisan appearance of the impeachment hearings are a result of GOP denial.
There's not bipartisan support.
Well, if the Republicans are in denial about the facts, if the Republicans do not want to honor their oath of office, then I don't think that this should be we should be characterized as partisan in any way because we are patriotic.
What's your question? The question is, how does that change your calculus moving forward, or does it, as you try to make the case to the American people?
No, the facts are, we said we want to see the facts, and we want the American people to see the facts. Whatever decision is made, and it has not been made yet, whatever decision is made to go forward will be based on our honor and our oath of office, not on the resistance to the truth of the Republicans on the other side. I think the sad tragedy of all of this is the behavior of the president and the defense of that behavior by the Republicans. Yes, sir.
And that was Nancy Pelosi speaking earlier today. And you're listening to the news on WBAI, listener-sponsored local and independent radio news. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In June, the New York State Legislature passed a bill, years in the making, that will allow workers who've been stiffed to bring liens against their employers so that workers can get paid. It's estimated to be a $1 billion problem in New York, especially for low-income service workers. WBAI's Daniel Vila was at a rally in support of the bill at the governor's Manhattan offices. The bill still needs Governor Andrew Cuomo's signature. Vila spoke with an organizer of the rally.
Carlos, can you please tell us when the bill was signed and what your expectations today?
Okay. The SWEAT bill passed in June this year, 2019. The Senate and the Assembly, they passed. But right now, we demanding, I don't know what Cuomo waiting for, we demanding to sign the SWEAT bill because we facing wage theft. I used to work in Domino's Pizza. I'm working for 16 years in this country, like in restaurant, deli, factories, retail stores. So when we come together and we sue the boss, we take them to the court because they don't pay minimum wage, overtime, and other bad treatments. What they do is they declare bankruptcy, shut down the restaurant, change the name, transfer the access. And why this has happened? Because the law in New York State is very weak.
And Carlos, would this new law stop that? One of the main problems, like you say, is that many of these workplaces, when they steal, when they do not pay the workers their salaries, they change their names and they just make believe it's a different company. Does this new sweat bill, anti-sweat bill, address itself to that problem?
Yes, the sweat bill address the problem, because if Cuomo signed, that's going to be a law. So when workers sue the boss for minimum wage and overtime, that going together with the lawsuit, that going to freeze immediately the access. They cannot move the properties, they cannot shut down the restaurant until they pay the workers while they own.
Thank you so much, Carlos Herreras, for National Mobilization Against Sweatshops.
That was WBAI's Daniel Vila reporting. The State Assembly sponsor of the bill is Assemblymember Linda P. Rosenthal of the Upper West Side in Hell's Kitchen. She says the new law is years in the making.
We call it the SWEAT Bill, which stands for Securing Wages Earned Against Theft. And I introduced it quite a few years ago in reaction to a situation at Saigon Grill, which was a very profitable and popular restaurant serving Vietnamese food on the Upper West Side. And the restaurant owners took great advantage of the delivery workers, fining them for small, what they called infractions, not paying them properly, not giving them the wages that they earned. Finally, the workers went to court to collect what was owed to them. The judge awarded them millions of dollars, and they were not able to collect those funds. In the interim, Saigon Grill owner was convicted, sent to prison. They sold the establishment to someone who promised me that he would pay the workers what was owed to them, and instead he closed as well. What we learned from that is while you may be in the right and you may get a judgment in your favor from the courts, businesses have learned how to outfox the system. A number of ways are to file for bankruptcy, just close down or reopen under an LLC or a different name or sell it to a relative, but all hidden behind the shroud of LLCs. And the workers can never collect their rightly earned wages.
How does your bill address this problem?
What it essentially does is provides a pathway for action on the part of workers. So let's say this happened to some workers in a restaurant or any other kind of retail business. It could be a nail salon. It could be any other business. They would go to court and have to convince a judge that with the evidence they had, their case had a good chance of being successful. At that point, the judge would allow them to place a lien on the business. The owner could not just abscond, could not just close down and thus flee from paying the judgment. So it keeps them in business. They can still operate. They can still go about their business. They just can't close down and avoid responsibility and the payments they owe their workers.
How widespread is this problem?
The U.S. Department of Labor has estimated that New Yorkers are owed $1 billion in lost wages. We know that is pervasive throughout many industries. This is really needed as a way for workers to collect what is owed to them.
Who are usually the victims of these kind of things?
It's usually immigrants, low-wage workers, people of color, people who work in those kinds of service jobs. And owners of businesses often threaten them with report you to immigration or various other unpleasant results if they make a fuss that they're not being paid properly. What astounded me during the Saigon Grill strike, and there was a big strike and the whole neighborhood was actually involved because they supported the workers, many of them said, I would come back and work here because I take pride in my work and I did a good job and customers appreciated me, but I deserve to be paid what the legal wage is. That really impressed me. They were very dedicated to their jobs. They just needed to be paid properly. So we've seen this in many, many occasions. Knowing the consequences could be a lien on their business and suing some of the shareholders, you know, that'll make them think twice or three times before they don't pay their workers.
You expect the governor to sign this?
I am very hopeful, and that's why rallies such as the one that were held yesterday and talk. There's been a fantastic coalition of like more than 100 groups supporting this bill over the years. So I'm hopeful the governor will sign it. He's said many times that wage theft is a serious problem that he takes seriously. And as AG, he went after businesses that didn't pay their workers properly or wage theft. So I think he should sign it. Most people agree with me.
Assembly member Linda P. Rosenthal of the Upper West Side in Hell's Kitchen. And Con Edison, the ubiquitous New York energy company, has announced it wants a major rate hike this year. It would be a 40% increase in the cost of delivering gas. The company says it needs the money to pay for new natural gas infrastructure, but many poor New Yorkers are already smarting from what are the highest energy prices in the country. A third of poor New Yorkers are at least 60 days in arrears on their Con Ed bills, owing an average of $790. The hikes also disproportionately affect older New Yorkers. 25,000 older, disabled, and blind gas customers are 2 months or more behind on their bill. Energy activists say Con Ed's increases are meant to pay for fracked gas from Pennsylvania that they say adds to climate change.
Our rates are going to go up. And what we have a problem with is that last rate case that they had, they asked for $300 million and got it to address demand management, and they didn't spend it and they didn't do the upgrades that they promised, which is why we saw the blackout this past summer. So not only are they not doing what they say they're going to do with our money, but they shouldn't be spending more money on fracked gas infrastructure when we know that that is a direct result of climate change, and we need to be actually converting from fossil fuels to renewable energy like community geothermal loads, community solar. We have offshore wind coming in, so electrifying the grid is another solution.
What happens now? When is this going to go into effect?
They have to go to the Public Service Commission. So this happened over the spring. They say that the process is open to the public, but it's really not. It's a very complicated process to learn that this is an existence, that this is actually a process. To file as an intervener or a party to the case is also a long process. And the conversations that take place in negotiation rooms then become closed-doored and closed to the public. And interveners, like, for instance, Sane Energy Projects, were a small grassroots advocacy group, so we don't have the money to hire lawyers and experts. But Con Edison can use our ratepayer dollars to hire lawyers and experts for their side and go into like a 3 month or 4 months or so negotiation. And then what comes out is a hearing, which we just had last week in Manhattan. And Con Edison and the parties to the case will go to a judge, and the judge will make recommendations to the Public Service Commission, which there's five commissioners, and they're in charge of regulating all of our utilities in New York State.
And what's the Public Service Commission going to do, in your opinion?
We don't know, but we can speculate that they will probably allow Con Edison to continue doing business as usual. There are a few parties that would not sign on to what Con Edison has put forth because we don't believe that we should be giving them another dime of our money, especially since they haven't spent it right in the past, that we shouldn't be giving them another dime of our money to expand climate-changing fossil fuel infrastructure that is ruining our economy and our health and safety.
So what's next? What are you doing? What are you planning to do next?
We're also in the middle of National Grid is also asking for a rate hike to expand fracking infrastructure in New York City, and they're asking for a huge rate increase. We're actually in the middle of fighting a pipeline that's going through North Brooklyn right now, and we have a community meeting coming up on Monday, November 25th, at an event space on Morgan Avenue in North Brooklyn for people to come together. Senator Salazar will be there, and we're going to organize to halt the construction of more fracking infrastructure on our dime.
Well, where can people find out more about that?
You can go to saneenergy.org/NBK pipe, which is No North Brooklyn Pipeline.
Kim Fraycheck is director of the Sane Energy Project. And finally, criminal prosecution and convictions of polluters have fallen to quarter-century lows under the Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency, deepening 3 years of overall enforcement declines. That's according to Justice Department statistics. And while the administration says it's focusing on quality over quantity in pollution cases, using its enforcement resources to go after the biggest and worst offenders, an AP analysis found little sign of that so far in court cases closed in 2019. The criminal pollution cases initiated and won this year under the Trump administration appear to be smaller one-offs, such as an Alaska fishing captain who let a reality TV show crew film his cheering crew as it dumped waste overboard into an Alaskan strait in 2017. An EPA spokesperson said it was not unusual for complex criminal cases to take years to move from initial investigations to filing of charges. She said some statistics, such as 1 year rise from 107 to 133 in total numbers of defendants charged in criminal cases, were up in 2019. But an environmental watchdog group and a former regional EPA criminal enforcement official said 3 years of falling enforcement numbers show the Trump administration's gutting criminal investigations and prosecutions at the agency. And that's some of the news for Thursday, November 21st, 2019. The news is produced with Linda Perry, Daniel Villa, and Jesse Lent. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of the listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.